This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, directed to New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perron.
Hello friends, it's nice to have you with us once again for another edition of the show. Coming up in our main feature today, we're going to go back to the 1940s and 50s to find out about Radio Canada International and what it was like working for what was then known as the CBC International Service. We'll be joined by one of the service's first German announcers, Eric Koch.
The report by the Foreign Affairs Committee that was looking into the implications of the cuts to the BBC World Service is in. We'll look at some of the findings.
And also, Sanjen, one of the world-leading manufacturers of shortwave radios, has come out with a new model. It's called the ATS-909X, and we'll have a short review.
Media Network Plus, high on frequency and low on bandwidth.
First, here's Paulette with a look at some of the major headlines from the world of radio.
A new generation of managers is taking the reins at the U.S. government's radio and TV broadcasts into Cuba, promising to overhaul the station's programming in an effort to make them more relevant and reach a younger audience. The overhaul coincides with broader policy changes as President Barack Obama has shifted from the long-standing tactic of advocating the overthrow of Fidel Castro's communist government to one of encouraging more cultural and economic exchanges. Last October, 43-year-old Cuban-American attorney Carlos Garcia Perez took over the office of Cuba Broadcasting. Unlike Radio Martí's founders and most directors since, he is from Puerto Rico, not the anti-Castro exile enclave of Miami. Perez wasn't even born when the last Martí director, exile Pedro Roig, participated in the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961. Recently, it was reported that the BBC World Service was going to reinstate its Hindi broadcast. But it has just been discovered that the BBC World Service has no immediate plans to resume the three Hindi shortwave transmissions that have been added to the HFCC transmission schedule with an indicated start date of May 1, 2011. These are so-called wooden entries, which may be used in the future if additional funding can be found. But at the moment, the 1400 to 1500 UTC transmission is the only one on the air. The frequencies are 1413, 7565, 9685, 11795, and 15470 kHz. The Broadcasting Board of Governors has selected award-winning broadcaster and communications executive David Ensor to serve as the new director of the Voice of America. Mr. Ensor has been director for communications and public diplomacy of the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan since January of 2010. He'll join VOA in June this year. Mr. Ensor is a winner of a National Headliner Award and an Emmy-nominated broadcast journalist. His 32-year career in television and radio news included extensive reporting on international affairs. He covered the demise of communism in Russia and Poland, armed conflicts in Bosnia, Chechnya, El Salvador, and Afghanistan, and the U.S. response to the 9/11 attacks. He was CNN's national security correspondent and, prior to that, an ABC News correspondent with assignments in Washington, Moscow, Rome, and Warsaw. Ensor reported from Washington for National Public Radio, covering foreign policy and defense issues. Mr. Ensor is a member of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations and is fluent in French. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree with honors from the University of California, Berkeley. Mr. Ensor holds the Knight's Cross awarded by the President of Poland. The Swiss Broadcasting Corporation, SBC, has reported a loss for 2010 of 12.3 million Swiss francs, that's 13.7 million US dollars. The loss is considerably lower than the forecast of 74.5 million Swiss francs. The SBC said the better result was due to savings and efficiency measures, as well as more commercial revenue. Working in its favor were higher spending on advertising, cuts to IT and distribution costs, and the end of adjustments to the pension fund. The SBC said, however, that as the economic situation was still uncertain, the margin for financial flexibility would remain narrow, as more investment in technology and infrastructure was needed. Barring any surprises, it expects to end 2011 in the black. The result was an improvement of 34.4 million Swiss francs on 2009's loss of 46.7 million Swiss francs. Special thanks goes to Andy Sennett of the Media Network blog at Radio Netherlands Worldwide, and that's at blogs.rnw.nl/media network. Or you can find a link to them at www.pcjmedia.com.
On April 4th, the Foreign Affairs Committee in the United Kingdom released the findings of the committee looking into cuts to the BBC World Service and the effect that it would have on listeners around the world and to the interest of the United Kingdom. As we mentioned on the last edition of the program, the cuts to shortwave services would have a tremendous impact. Some of the services, like Russian, Ukrainian, Chinese, and others, have moved to web-based content. Yes, it's true that in many regions of the world, shortwave audiences have been declining over the past few years, compared with the audience figures from 25 years ago. But nevertheless, there are still many regions of the world that using shortwave still makes sense. The committee received many submissions from people around the world, including the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, who said the BBC World Service was Britain's greatest gift to the world. The area of the report that stands out is what the committee had to say about China.
We conclude that the decision to close BBC China's shortwave output in Mandarin does not meet the criteria for service closures set out by the BBC and the Foreign Secretary, particularly the criterion regarding the strategic importance of the countries they serve and the need of their populations for independent, impartial news. The shift from shortwave to online services in China will leave world service transmissions vulnerable to action taken by the Chinese government to suppress or block internet traffic. Although the number of shortwave listeners may be in gradual decline, the underlying strength of shortwave transmission remains that it is much harder to turn off, block, or criminalize compared to online provision. We recommend that the World Service should commit itself to longer-term support for an unreduced BBC China shortwave service in Mandarin.
Another area that the committee suggests not be reduced was the BBC Hindi service on shortwave. This service has been popular for many years. And when it was announced that it would be cut, many Hindi speakers came out to show their support for the service. The committee heard this and had this to say.
We conclude that the proposed closure of the BBC Hindi shortwave service is a matter of deep concern. The decision to offer the service a limited and temporary reprieve, contingent on alternative commercial sources of funding being found, offers only partial reassurance. We note that India is a major rising economic power and that the government has professed its wish to improve bilateral relations as a priority. We further note that the estimated savings from reducing world service operations in India at £680,000 are small in relation to the nearly 11 million listeners that will be lost. While we welcome the temporary reprieve of the BBC Hindi shortwave service while alternative funding models are explored, and we recognize that the service's audience is likely to continue to fall as a long-term trend, we recommend that the World Service re-examine the limited temporary reprieve and commit itself to longer-term support for an unreduced BBC Hindi shortwave service.
What many people were surprised about is the support from the Foreign Office Committee had for shortwave services to be reinstated and for long-term support for shortwave. Now, we don't have time to go into great detail what the report have. There just isn't time to do it here. But if you wish to read the full report, just go to www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus and look for this show, April 30th, and you'll find a link where you can read the full findings. This is Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio.
now for some more positive news about shortwave radio. Sanjin, one of the world's leading radio and shortwave radio manufacturers, has just come out with the long-awaited ATS-909X, an upgrade of the very popular ATS-909. Now, Keith, you've had one for a while now. What's the difference between ATS-909X and the original ATS-909?
Well, I think the first thing that stands out is how the radio looks. People will be familiar that most shortwave radios are either black or silvery plastic, and they look very utilitarian. This one, however, has a very clean, white, slick look with an absolutely, slick design. It doesn't look anything like a traditional shortwave radio.
Okay, so it looks good. What about the performance?
This is something that I'm very surprised about. Now, I've had my original ATS-909 for a couple of years now, and it served me well. And then I thought, okay, let me try this one. So I went out and I bought it, and it is almost like rediscovering a radio again. First of all, the tuning knob is on front. If you want to scan through the frequencies, it is so easy. You just, it's like a little wheel. You just turn with your hand. It is so user-friendly. The radio feels nice. The other thing that is amazing about it is the display. The original 909 has a very good display, but this one is even better and is much better lit than on the original radio. There are some other things about it that I love, because my shortwave radios, I mainly use batteries in it to reduce noise and interference. This radio, you can put rechargeable nickel metal hydrate batteries inside, and you can charge them inside the radio. And it is absolutely fantastic for that. The other thing, of course, that is a big improvement is it has a line in. So if you have an iPod and you're somewhere traveling, you can actually connect it up to this radio and listen to your iPod that way. The other thing that's also very nice about it is it has an audio out, especially for a Sanjin digital recorder, which is also out on the market right now. So you can actually program it to record shows that you want to listen to or stations that you want to listen to if you're not around. The radio is also highly sensitive. The chip inside, the DPS decoder, is amazing. It just performs so much better than the original 909. And I have to say, I absolutely love it.
Well, it sounds like quite the gadget, and sounds like you're having a lot of fun with it. Are there any disadvantages to the unit?
From a technical standpoint, no. From how the radio looks, and I know this is going to sound superficial because it looks great, no. But the area that I think is a little bit of a problem is the price. Now, I bought the radio here in Taiwan, so the price, of course, is going to be a lot cheaper than you'd find in other places. But the price that I've seen listed on some websites just astonishes me. Starting at $259 all the way up to $449. Now, this is a good radio, but for that price, I would suggest not buying it. but if somebody still wants to get the radio, the only thing I could suggest is look around on eBay, because there are a number of retailers based here in Taiwan that have eBay shops, and you can probably get the receiver for a lot less money, including the shipping, than you will find at any retailer in North America or Europe. Now, I recently wrote about this on one blog, the DXer.ca blog from Colin Newell, and some guy responded back. He said, yeah, but if I buy the radio from somebody in Taiwan or Hong Kong, what about the warranty? Well, the nice advantage about Sanjin is they do have offices and service stations in many different places. So if anything does go wrong, it's a worldwide warranty, and you can contact Sanjin in your own country or whoever the distributor is, and they will help you.
If you'd like to know more about the radio, we'll have a video review up soon at pcjmedia.com, so check it out when it's available. Radio Canada International was for many years one of the most respected international broadcasters in the world. It still is today, but because of major cutbacks over the years, it is a shadow of its former self. Canada's entry into international broadcasting is relatively late compared to the BBC and Voice of America. The idea to create an international service was announced by Canadian Prime Minister Mackenzie King in 1942 and became a reality with the signing of an order in council on September 18th that same year.
Towards the end of 1944, studios in Montreal and a relay station in Sackville, New Brunswick were completed and ready for testing. The first test transmissions began December 25, 1944, and was broadcast to Canadian troops in Europe. At the same time, psychological broadcasts were also going out targeted towards Germany. At the start of 1945, just months before the war was about to end, it was announced that the CBC International Service, as it was known then, was ready to go. On February 25, 1945, the CBC International Service signed on. The first voice heard on the service was that of Prime Minister Mackenzie King. If you'd been listening to radio on that date in 1945, this is what you would have heard.
This is Canada calling. Ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister of Canada.
This evening marks the formal opening of Canada's International Broadcasting Service. The program is wholly Canadian in its creation and spirit. Most appropriately, it has been prepared for the entertainment of Canadians on active service abroad. I should like the first words spoken officially over the international service of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation to be words of greeting to Canada's armed forces serving on and beyond the seas. I should like them to be words of unbounded admiration and gratitude on behalf of all the people of Canada. I do not know that I can better express what is most in the hearts of all of us here at home than to say that we are hoping and praying for a speedy end to the horrors and sacrifices of war, and above all, for your early and triumphant return. The establishment of this service in Canada is of historic significance. It will serve both a national and an international purpose. It will bring the voice of Canada to our own sons and daughters in other lands. It will also bring Canada into closer contact with other countries. In the better world for which you are fighting, Canada will have a large part to play in furthering between nations the mutual understanding and goodwill on which the permanence of peace depends. Through its many-sided contribution in the fight for freedom, Canada has won a place of its own in the world. You, above all others, have shown the world how men of differing backgrounds, origins, and creeds can fight side by side in mutual tolerance and mutual respect in defense of a common nationality. Into the historic partnership of our two races, we in Canada have admitted thousands who were born of other racial stocks and who speak other tongues. They, one and all, have found in Canada a homeland where nationality means equality and freedom, not domination and slavery. Without the ideal of equality among men, without the vision of human brotherhood, the Canadian nation could never have come into being. Only by the extension of the ideals of mutual tolerance, of racial cooperation, of equality among men, can nationality come to serve humanity. Only as nationality serves humanity can mankind hope to substitute cooperation for conflict in the relations between the nations of the world. International radio broadcasting is a powerful means of helping to extend these ideals throughout the world. Tonight, Canada enters the world radio arena. As we undertake this new service, let us resolve that in peace as in war, we will be true to the ideals you are so valiantly upholding, ideals which have made our country a nation. The unity of Canada belongs not only to Canada, it belongs to mankind. If we are true to ourselves, Canadian unity may well serve as a model for the wider unity of humanity. In the unity of mankind lies the one sure foundation of enduring peace.
Prime Minister Mackenzie King, February 25, 1945, with the inaugural broadcast of the new international service. In those early years, RCI, or the CBC International Service, had languages like Danish, Dutch, Norwegian, German, and Swedish, including English and French.
During the Cold War, Polish, Russian, Hungarian, Slovak, and Ukrainian were added. The services that were introduced at the start of the Cold War were cut March 25, 1991, when RCI suffered a massive budget cut which saw a total of 13 languages dropped. But our focus today is the early years, the 1940s and 50s. The German service was staffed by refugees who, after the war, did programming aimed at the German Democratic Republic, or East Germany, during the Cold War. One of those early broadcasters was Eric Koch, who did broadcasts in German during the testing stage.
Canada, Kala, Danmark.
Guten Abend, hier spricht Kanada.
Qui Radio Canada.
Ici Radio Canada.
Transmite Radio Canada.
It a Canada Radio.
Guten Abend, Leustreif, hier ist Radio Canada.
Canada volá Československo.
French, German, Dutch, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, Danish, Norwegian, Swedish, Czech, Slovak, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, and Hungarian are the languages of the International Service of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Why should Canada be broadcasting to these people?
The first head of the German section was Helmut Blum, and we were friends, and he had already done some work in the summer of 1944 for the, I think it may well have been called the Psychological Warfare Committee in Ottawa,
right.
Which had nothing, which had, I really, it's kind of obscure. There were a number of people involved in it. It had a relation to the War Information Board, and there was somebody else called Charles Wasserman who was working there in some obscure capacity. It was wartime, and they were German speakers and interested in participating in something. And Blumer then must have met a few people, and that was around the time when they were looking for personnel to staff the new service, which had been planned for a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
It took. They had all kinds of problems, equipment problems, engineering problems, to set up the transmitters and all that.
Right,
so after the usual delays, when they were getting ready, they were assembling the staff. And so Blumer then came to me and said, would you like to join me? And that is how it came about.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that the CBC International Service took some time to get on the air, because in many ways they were one of the latecomers on the shortwave dial.
Yes, they were latecomers. Mm-hmm. Quite right, quite right. They were latecomers. And there is a book about all this, about the early, about this planning and the various delays and setbacks. And it is by Arthur Siegel, and you might be able to get hold of it.
So when you were working in the German section back then, yes, at the when you began work at the end of the Second World War, what were some of the things that you and the German section were trying to do?
Yes, well, we did the usual format of the half-hour show.
Mm-hmm.
Was starting with the news, which we wrote ourselves in German, and it was based on various news services, of which I remember Agence France-Presse was one. And they came in by the ticker tape, kind of, very old-fashioned from our point of view now. And we wrote the news based on the raw material that came our way. And of course, it was a kind of honor system. They had to trust us, the brass, the management,
mm-hmm,
had to trust us, because nobody could control or check what we were saying. So it was a kind of gentleman's agreement, not only with us, but with all the languages. There was a loose, that's quite interesting, there was a loose kind of policy control. In the early days, this was a very, very intelligent and knowledgeable lady called Sally Solomon, yes. And she knew a number of languages. She spoke some German and possibly a little Dutch. I don't know about that. She may have known some Russian, and therefore she could check up on the Czechs. There was a Czech section, Walter Boschmarker,
mm-hmm,
and a very much of a Dutch section, right from the beginning. There was, right, and I remember them very clearly, the first head of the Dutch section, who lasted only about a year, was called Van Berkom, I think. But she, I don't know, for some reason, she left after a year or a few months. But her successor stayed there for some years, and her name was Maya van Steensel. And she was a major and interesting person. She had been, so she said, working in the Dutch resistance. And she made a great fuss about having single-handedly killed a few Germans. As a matter of fact, she had to tease us Germans. You see, there were two, first Blumer and I, and then a third one was added, as I think I mentioned. And we were all Jewish refugees. Blumer was not Jewish, but he was half Jewish. But he was certainly very much of an anti-Nazi refugee. And Maya knew this very well. But she teased us, and she said she hated Germans, and she was going to kill some more Germans. And she had a dagger on her desk, which she wanted us to know was blood-stained with the blood of Germans. So she, whenever we passed her desk, she put a dagger in her hand and kind of teasingly threatened us.
That's kind of frightening.
It was very funny. I mean, it was funny and was not funny.
Mm-hmm.
It was not entirely funny. And then after she had told us how much she hated the Germans, about two or three years later, we added another person from our internment camps, another refugee called Rolf Jessen, later Rolf James. He died about 5 years ago, or maybe more. And after all this fuss about hating all the Germans and liking and very much enjoying killing the Germans because she was proving it with her dagger. She then decided to marry Rolf. She married one of us. and he was a good friend of ours. Maya became a very good friend of ours too. After some years, he was there for years. We were all good friends. She married Rolf, and Rolf had a little of money, which was unlike the rest of us. He had a little money. She enjoyed spending Rolf's money, and then they got a divorce. And I don't know what happened to Maya. Then I think Maya went to Australia or something like that. She was a very adventurous lady.
Back in those days when you did the programming, was the programming live, or did you record it onto disc and then it was repeated periodically through the day?
Well, we did it live. We broadcast live. All our programs were live, of course. But some talks, or tiny little documentaries, but mainly talks, were recorded on disc. But our broadcasting was that. We had freelance contributors. I mean, there were enough people whom we trusted, who were good enough in Montreal, on whom we could call. We had some regular freelancers who were literate and could write well. And I'm sure the Dutch had a much greater problem because there were probably fewer people who could speak Dutch well enough, could write well enough to be acceptable to the Dutch section. The staff then had to do a lot more work if they couldn't find the freelancers to do it for them.
When you were doing those programs, what was going through your mind? Did you think that you were doing something special at the time?
What were you asking for the subject matter? We had a political if we did the news, and it was followed by a political commentary written by one of us, written either by Bloom or by me, or when the third person arrived, Edgar, then by him. And it was, took great pride in doing this as well as we could. And we had it checked by the policy person, whose German was good enough. And when we had any problems and didn't know how to handle it, and when we had a policy dilemma, we would seek advice mainly from her. And she was directly in touch with external affairs. On matters of policy, we came under external affairs, not the CBC. The CBC administered the international service, the RCI. We came under the CBC in personnel matters and salaries and all that was the CBC's. But the policy was for that external affairs had to take responsibility. And it was a very delicate, difficult matter. How could they trust anybody? First of all, it started in wartime. And then, after 1948, when the Berlin blockade and the Cold War broke out. So there was a great political sensitivity. And a lot of people were left-wing, so it was a difficult, politically very hard time. When the Cold War broke out, we had, right after the war, in September 1948, we had a great spy scandal when a little clerk from the Soviet embassy in Ottawa defected and incriminated a lot of people in Ottawa and all kinds of people were suddenly incriminated as having had something to do with the Soviet embassy. So there was you can imagine, everybody was scared, just stiff about, there was a witch hunt going on.
So within the CBC International Service,
everywhere,
German section,
everywhere.
Really?
Yeah, but particularly in our organization, which was highly political, and where you have that problem of supervision, because management, what could they know about what went on in the Czech section? And even the Dutch, the German, a lot of people speak Germans, but Dutch, not many people speak Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to trust the staff. They had to trust them. And therefore, the head of the Dutch section had to be a person they could trust. And the head of the Czech section, and there were even fewer people who spoke Czech, the head of the Czech section was rather a formidable person called Walter Smolka. And, they did trust him, and quite rightly. And they did trust Blume, and they trusted me quite rightly, because we were trustworthy. We were honorable people. But how could they know?
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Canada International on the air with a program of particular interest to Canadians abroad. Morning news in English and French from the newsrooms of Radio Canada International is transmitted to Europe, the Middle East, and Africa.
Yes. Did it ever happen, especially at the beginning of the Cold War, that
yes.
Ottawa started to, say, investigate announcers that were working at the CBC International Service?
Yes,
to,
of course.
Really?
And not only that, the RCMP was involved. Yes, of course. They were, okay. And then at one time, in 1949, I think, the External Affairs sent a kind of a junior officer whose name was... It wasn't McDermott, but it was a kind of Scottish name, McDonald or something. They sent a man, and one of their, who later became an ambassador, down to our office in Montreal for a few months to watch us, and it was the poor man. That was very hard for him. How could he? What could he do? He knew a little bit of I think he knew French. He may have known some German. I don't remember that. He certainly didn't know Czech. He certainly didn't know Dutch. And then we had the Scandinavian languages. We had Swedish and Norwegian. They don't know. How could they know what was covered? So this poor man had to get to know us. So he had meals with us in the cafeteria, and chatted with us and tried to make friends with us. And he seemed to be a perfectly nice guy. But we knew exactly what he was doing. he had been sent there to learn, to examine us, and to sound us out, and to find out whether we were possibly God knows what communists. And so the poor man had a great problem. But then there was a huge crisis, McCarthyism. This was more serious than the first crisis after the war, the Guzenko. Guzenko was a Soviet defector in September 1945. But that was bad enough. That was the great first spy scandal after the war. And Canada, as was grown up at last, had a real spy scandal, made headlines all over the world. But 5 years later, when McCarthy got going in the United States, there was a reflection of that in Canada, which was, unlike McCarthy, which was very public, because Senator McCarthy got up in the Senate and named names and accused the State Department. In Canada, this was done much more discreetly. All this happened behind closed doors. People were accused. It was much worse in Canada in many ways because it was not public. And in the CBC, in our service, there were two people, I think, who were considered unreliable. And one of them was this lady I've just mentioned, Sally Solomon. It was utterly unjust. She was as reliable as the Governor General. It was totally unjust. This was a real witch hunt. And she was removed and given some other job, and then she left. And the other person who was under suspicion, who was left-wing, but not no security risk, of course, who was being investigated, he was the CBC management in Toronto, of Ottawa head office, I guess, the president, high officer, rescued him and put him in charge of television programming, which was just starting in Canada. Television started in 1952. That was the height of the McCarthy crisis. And the CBC behaved very well in protecting its own people against witch hunters. And this man became the first program director of CBC television, and it was a terrific success. He was a very, very excellent man with great talent for that particular job.
What was the reaction from the audience at the time? Did you get many...
Very good question. Very good question. Of course, during the war, we had no idea. Mm-hmm. During the war, it was just guesswork. And it made us all very peculiar because we were talking into the ether without any assurance that we would be heard. Although once a week we were carried by the BBC. I'm talking about the German section.
Mm-hmm.
We were carried by the CBC, and once a week we were carried by the Voice of America. And there we had some assurance that they, at least, would get through to Germany in wartime. But after the war, we then began to get mail from listeners. And not too much, but enough to give us a feeling that we had an audience in Germany.
During the Cold War period, when you were doing the programming in German, did the German Democratic Republic try to jam RCI's or the CBC
International's
German program?
I was not aware of that. No, good question. I was never aware of that, of the actual jamming.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have been very hard for them to do that, but it could have technically, but it was possible. But I don't remember any talk about that. But you see, it was really not worth it for them. We were too small. And my God, in the German, in the DDR, they got all the West German stuff in German.
Mm-hmm.
So it was relatively, compared to that, we were relatively unimportant.
Right. You were almost like a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, that's right. The shortwave was then relative. However, in Europe, I don't know how it is today, but shortwave broadcasting, receiving shortwave broadcasts from abroad, was very big in Europe, certainly during the war, secretly, in Nazi-occupied, I'm sure in Holland. And also, it was an accepted way of broadcasting, so that people, even those who were not particularly interested in political stuff, enjoyed listening to programming on shortwave. In North America, this is unknown. This was unknown, except for a few people who were interested in the technical aspects, who were kind of shortwave fanatics, who enjoyed it as a kind of like collectors or as a hobby. But it was not a matter of a tradition as it was in Europe to listen on shortwave.
Well, you know, we've seen, especially since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, we've seen a tremendous amount of change in international broadcasting. A number of stations have either gone off the air, or they've dropped languages, or they've stopped broadcasting programming to target areas. RCI is still around today. Of course, it's a lot smaller than it even was maybe 15 years ago. Do you think that today international services like Radio Canada International, Radio Netherlands, Deutsche Welle, Voice of America, and BBC still play a vital part in informing people around the world?
I'm the wrong person to ask, but I would assume that it has changed its character, but it's still a major factor. For example, you probably know, and you will, what RCI is now doing.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches languages, for example. It teaches, don't they have to teach English to the Chinese? And this, don't they do a kind of educational work? We did that too. We did broadcasts for the German schools on disc. We started that right after the war. It is a different function. It's an educational function. But I think, now take Deutsche Welle. I, in Toronto, take the Deutsche Welle on television. My cable system, my television system, allows me, for paying very little, $5 or $6 a month, to get the Deutsche Welle on television.
Mm-hmm.
I don't listen to it on radio, because I do very little listening on radio anyway. But the Deutsche Welle I listen to every day on television.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it, if I do it, so will, I don't know anybody else who does it. Yeah, I do, I know I'm one other person who does it. But it's still worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
The governments and whatever foundations are involved are still prepared to spend money and effort on international broadcasting of some kind.
How long were you at the CBC International Service?
9 years. I was there until 1953,
mm-hmm.
from 44 to 53.
And when you left, was that a decision that you made, or were there cuts at the time?
I made it. Really? I made it. I had enough of it. I had done it long enough. I was then kind of tired of it.
Uh-huh.
Also, I had a new boss, although I got on quite well with him. But I was... I didn't feel very happy under him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very much a Cold War thing. The CBC then, or the external affairs, whatever, the authorities, removed the man who had been, I thought, very good, Ira Dilworth, because they didn't trust him. They didn't trust him, that he was the wrong man, they thought, and in a sense, justifiably, because he was not very well equipped with the kind of political experience that was required at the time of the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
when everything was very politicized. So they removed him. And it was a great crisis. He had a heart attack. He was... terribly, found it extremely, extremely difficult to accept the decision that he was the wrong man. So they removed him and put another man on top of us, who was an unemployed ambassador and a very strong anti-communist. And he did not, it was like a new regime that was not attractive. I had no trouble with this new boss, but it was somehow I'd had it done enough. I was promoted, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I was promoted. I was in charge of Italian, of the Italian section, for which I had no particular qualifications. but they needed somebody, and then I quite enjoyed that, and I had to find staff. It was mainly a personnel problem to find people whose language and culture was adequate. I mean, they had to be Italian. They had to be native Italian. And then we tried to import one Italian broadcaster who had some considerable experience and reputation in Italy, who was interested in coming to Canada. And I spent a lot of time and energy trying to get him to come to Canada, to come, and had all the immigration and the Italian embassy and everybody involved in this. And in the end, it didn't work. In the end, it didn't. I wasted a tremendous amount of time and effort, and it didn't work. I can't remember why. It might have worked. But I was very totally incompetent. I mean, I don't want to say incompetent. I was totally unqualified to be in charge of a section whose language I didn't really understand. And so all I could do was do the best I could. I learned a little Italian, but not enough. The difficult things from a policy point of view are all very subtle and difficult, and you have to know the language very well in order to decide whether something is proper and justified. And I certainly was not good enough for that.
And I was speaking there with Eric Koch, one of the first broadcasters from the newly formed CBC International Service in 1945, now known as Radio Canada International. Koch left the International Service in 1953, but remained with the CBC until he retired in 1979. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition, the April edition, that is, of Media Network Plus. If you wish to get in touch with us, our snail mail address is PCJ Radio, Media Network Plus, 8th floor, that's 8th floor, number 47, Lane, L-A-N-E, 31, Lane 31, San Min Road, that's S-A-N like Norman, M like Mother, I like Ivan, N like Norman, San Min Road. I'm running out of air here. Taipei, and you of course know how to spell Taipei, Taiwan, ROC 22070. Now, in case you didn't have time to write that down, you can always get the information at our website, which Paulette will give to you now.
And that is www.pcjmedia.com. Now, if you've fallen asleep during Keith's rambling of the snail mail address and you're a little more IT savvy, you can drop us an email, and that address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. And also, if you'd like to download the program, it is at the website, pcjmedia.com, and there are transcripts available of the show as well, and you'll find all the links and all the information to that at the website, which once again is www.pcjmedia.com. There's lots of great stuff at the PCJ Media website, so I encourage you to spend some time browsing around there. So for me, Paulette Macquarie in Vancouver, Canada.
And for me, Keith Perron in Taipei, Taiwan.
We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.
And best 73s.
Yeah.